We move to United States versus Sherrod.
May it please the court. In all criminal cases, the government must prove each element beyond reasonable doubt, even those the defendant does not contest. There is no hierarchy of elements. The strength of the evidence on some elements doesn't make up for the weakness of the evidence on another. Mr. Sherrod is making a very limited challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence in this case. He is only challenging the evidence presented on the jurisdictional element of the carjacking count, and that is where I'd like to focus my argument. Time permitting, I'll get into the Miranda issue and the Sixth Amendment issue.
Well, is there any real dispute that the car was transported in interstate commerce?
The dispute is whether the government proved that element beyond a reasonable doubt. All we know about the evidence...
Are there any Cadillacs that are made in Illinois?
Right.
No evidence that I'm aware of.
Could the court taken judicial notice of the fact that there are no Cadillacs made in Illinois?
I don't believe that that's a proposition that the court could take judicial notice of.
Why not?
It's not a matter of common knowledge.
Why? I don't know why it wouldn't be. I've never tried a case as a district judge where the jurisdictional element hasn't been agreed to. And you can make an agreement by silence, I suppose. And this is, it just seems so obvious here that there are no Cadillacs made in Illinois, and the court could have taken judicial notice of that fact.
Well, the simple fact is that it didn't. And under Federal Rule of Evidence 201G, if the court was going to take judicial notice of a fact like that, it had to tell the jury that it was doing so and allow the jury to decide for itself whether the jurisdictional element had been proven.
Well, was this, am I reading this incorrectly, that this Lieutenant Patrick Kane testified, and he testified that he'd done an inquiry of the Secretary of State to determine where the Escalade was manufactured and... Or at least the state of origin, and he said he did, and he found out the vehicle was in Arlington, Texas. That was part of the record.
It is part of the record.
Right, and I understand you may think that, I mean, there was no evidence opposing that, was there?
No, there was not. And again, as the Supreme Court has said, and as this court has said, the government has the duty and the burden to prove each element, even though the element may not be contested.
Yeah, but see here, the problem is if there had been some objection or something raised, this issue would have been gone into with a little more detail. And it's hard to let somebody lay in the weeds, so to speak. And I know you weren't trial counsel here. I think you've done a magnificent job of raising the issues, and particularly your notice regarding the affidavits from these trial lawyers is excellent work. But that's the problem. When there's no objection, you just move on. It's such an insignificant issue in the case.
It is not.
As a matter of common sense, it is.
Well, as a matter of law, it's not. Because, again, it's an essential element of the crime, which the government has to come forward with evidence proving it beyond a reasonable doubt. Here's what, going to your question, Judge Williams, here is what Detective Kane testified to. He was first asked, have you conducted an inquiry with the Secretary of State to determine the origin of the vehicle?
Mm-hmm.
He said yes.
Mm-hmm.
Then, following up from that, the government asked, well, does the Secretary of State maintain a database that allows the police to trace a VIN number? He said, well, there is a database. I don't know if that's the Secretary of State's database or who actually maintains that, but I do know it's maintained by the state. Asked, Well, did you conduct an inquiry based on the VIN number with the state? He said, I had that done. Yes, I had that done. That indicates quite clearly that he personally did not look up the VIN himself. That's it. There's no printout from the database. There's no documents from GM.
What's the evidence before the jury? What is the evidence before the jury? Where the vehicle was made?
That's it.
Well,
Detective Kane's testimony.
Right. The evidence before the jury is the car was made in Texas.
Well, the problem is that it's based on two levels
of hearsay. The problem is there was no objection to it.
And under 103...
Well, the only evidence before the jury is it was made in Texas.
But under 103D, the Federal Rules of Evidence...
You've got to make the objection.
But again, 103D allows for plain error review. Even allowing for this evidence and allowing for its admission, the evidence is still not substantial enough to prove that this vehicle moved in interstate commerce. There are too many unknowns. The exact source of the evidence of the database is unknown. The accuracy of the database is unknown. Whether the police generally rely upon this database is unknown. There is no testimony that Kane personally traced the VIN. The identity of the person who did wasn't testified to at trial. Again, at most we know that some unidentified individual traced the VIN through some unidentified database.
See, at the risk of beating a dead horse here, had there been an objection and a light would have gone on, maybe this is an issue in the case, the judge could have been asked to take judicial notice of the fact, and it is clear that they don't make Cadillacs of any sort, Escalades included, in the state of Illinois.
Well, as Judge Posner said in his dissent in Knopp, which is discussed in the reply brief, the defense is not obliged to help the government prove its case. It's not obliged to tell the government, hey, you might need a little better evidence on that. That is not the defendant's obligation. The defendant has no obligation to come forward.
If that were the case, you wouldn't need to make objections at all, would you?
I do think that the better course of action is definitely to make an objection. You'll get no dispute with me on that point. The temptation in this case is to affirm because the evidence on the substantive elements is strong and, as this court is indicating, jurisdiction is typically easy to prove. But that would be a mistake. The government has the burden to prove jurisdiction just like the substantive elements, beyond a reasonable doubt, which it did not do. And therefore, the court should reverse. Moving now to the confrontation issue, I just want to make one point. Under whatever test this court applies, whether it's Crawford versus Washington or Ohio versus Roberts, the government had to show unavailability. There is no exception for the jurisdictional element. Out-of-court declarations on the jurisdictional element may seem reliable because the element is easy to prove, but confrontation is still required, and the government didn't show unavailability.
So let me just go back to this issue of what the agent testified to, the officer testified to. I mean, is there any, in sort of this plain error analysis, when we look at the fourth condition, the error seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings or affects substantial rights. Is there in there somewhere where we would do a harmless error analysis?
No, you could not apply harmless error because there was no other evidence on this point. So if this evidence is insufficient or if it was plain error to admit it, you have to reverse. It can't be harmless error. The question is, would the defendant probably have been acquitted but for the admission of this evidence? And he clearly would have been because, again, jurisdiction is an essential element just like all the substantive elements. If I could, I'd like to move to the Miranda issue. And the question here is whether an agitated no is a no. When a suspect says in an irritated tone, I'm not going to talk about nothing, is that an invocation of the right to remain silent? If it is, this court should remand for a new trial, because I do not think there is any legitimate question that the defendant's invocation was not scrupulously honored, and I don't think there's any legitimate question that it was harmless error.
Well, didn't he say, I mean, in the context of all this, I'm not talking to you until you give me, put me in the picture, tell me what it's about?
He said twice, that is part of the conversation. He said, I'm not going to talk about nothing, twice. He was clearly agitated, and rightfully so. He had been arrested, and he wanted to know what was going on, as Judge Caney has indicated. But the police wouldn't tell him what was going on until they could get through their advice of rights form, the waiver form.
And then hadn't they made some mention before he even made that statement of kind of a derogatory manner in which he was referred to by his co-defendants or others that were involved? Or maybe I'm jumping ahead to another case.
I think that may be another case, Your Honor.
All right. Let me get back to then this is a question I have. How do you distinguish the facts in this case from Banks? Because when you look at Banks and we look at the statement that Sherrard made, it does lend itself to an interpretation that it was an expression of anger or frustration, not him indicating he wants to remain silent.
Yes, Your Honor. There are three points I'd like to make about Banks. And the statement is quite similar. In Banks, the defendant said, "Get the F out of my face. I don't have nothing to say." Now, in that case, there was no videotape of the statement. Here there is. And there, the court naturally had to defer to the magistrate judge's conclusion that there was an ambiguous invocation of the right. This court said, our conclusion is not compelled, but then went on to say, or excuse me, the magistrate judge's conclusion is not compelled, but then went on to say, well, because the determination depended to a very great extent on the demeanor of the witnesses involved, we will defer. And that was the correct decision. Here there is a videotape. The court needn't defer to the district judge's conclusion. It can view the evidence itself. The other point about Banks is there was some time gap between the defendant's invocation of his right and the questioning that elicited the inculpatory statements. There was no inculpation immediately when the defendant made his statement. He made it in a car ride, I think, to jail. And then 2 hours later, he made no inculpatory statements then. 2 hours later, he was re-Mirandized. And then they asked him more questions, and then he made his inculpatory statements. There is no gap in time here. The defendant made his statement. They didn't even stop to acknowledge it. They went through the form, and then he started talking. And the final point I'd like to make about Banks, very quickly, is that in that case, the court ruled that any Miranda violation was harmless error. But the statement there was very similar to Banks, and here the defendant said, I don't want to talk no more, and I don't want to talk about it anymore. And the court said, well, any error is harmless. But stop the questioning, please. When the defendant indicates he wants to quit talking, stop the questioning. In Banks, this court found no violation. In Davis, the court suggested there might be a violation. In Banks, you had an angry defendant. In Davis versus Greer, perhaps there was no angry defendant.
Yeah, it was Banks where there was some derogatory reference.
Correct.
That was the case I was thinking of. Okay.
So how do you reconcile all these cases? Based on their tone? To me, that seems illogical. The statements are substantively identical. In Miranda, the court said, interrogation must cease once a suspect indicates in any manner at any time prior to or during questioning that he wishes to remain silent. So tone shouldn't matter. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Bass.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, the defendant in this case is asking this court to reverse his conviction for what the district court called a cold, eyeballed, stalked execution, and even go further and to prevent his retrial for want of evidence on the basis of an issue that was never objected to, never disputed, never even mentioned at trial, and which on appeal is indisputable. This court should reject that argument. Now, if I may, Your Honors, at the outset, address this post-briefing notice that the defendant filed and say to Your Honors that The government contemplated from the outset in this case filing a motion to supplement the record. And we candidly acknowledge that this issue would never have arisen had there been a confirmation of record at trial that this stipulation occurred. But we did consider filing a motion to supplement the record, and under the rule, the first circumstance where that's appropriate is if the parties consent. And we sought that consent, and it was refused.
You're talking about the Cadillac Escalade.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right,
we sought to supplement.
So it was right, and it was refused. And you would agree, though, this is kind of, I mean, it appears that it's hearsay that it's based it on because he said he had that done. So he didn't personally do it, and he also didn't say which state agency the search occurred with. I mean, this is thin, don't you think?
Your Honor, I would agree that if looking just at the cold record, that there is a hearsay issue that arises. Mm-hmm. but that's not the question before the court. The question before the court is whether, given the lack of an objection.
Oh, I understand we're at a plain error standard, but what I'm saying is this is pretty thin. I understand there was no objection. That obviously, if there had been objection, there would have been notice, and this would have been cleaned up. So we're beyond that now. We're at plain error. And
well, the point I was making, Your Honor, about that is that I concluded, that this court's jurisprudence on the issue of supplementing the record did not provide a basis for us to seek to supplement the record on a contested motion.
Right.
And
so you're stuck with what's in here.
Well, now we have the defendant filing this notice of what actually occurred at trial. And what actually occurred was that there was an agreement between the parties that this evidence would come in the manner in which it did. Now, if the record reflected that at the outset, that would be an example of waiver. We don't even get to the issue on appeal if there's waiver. And there clearly was, by the defendant's own filing, an
well,
example.
You're not saying that we have to consider these affidavits. Are you comfortable to stand on the record as it exists without that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's what I would have thought.
I'm simply making the point that it's ironic that there was a filing of the very thing that the defendant refused to agree to in the beginning.
Well, but in defense of counsel, I thought that was explained very appropriately that to all candor with the court, that's the reason that these affidavits were filed.
I agree, Your Honor. And my only point is that in looking at the manner in which the government could have done that, I concluded that this court's jurisprudence under Rule 10 didn't give us the ability to file that without consent.
The problem but here is that it should have been stated as a stipulation of the parties.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we have to look at these affidavits to find that out. We do look at them now, and we see that that was actually the case. But on the basis of this record, those kind of things are usually always agreed to anyhow.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's why if you look at this court's statement by Judge Easterbrook writing for the court in Davenport, it happens all the time that issues are discussed among the parties and only those issues about which there is a fair basis for dispute are the issues presented to the court. Those decisions are all the time expressed, oftentimes by silence. This is an example of such a case.
So is this sort of a common practice in your district that that things like this happen by silence, you know, when you get an outright rejection of the stipulation, because that's how I understand the record.
Your Honor, I would say that I wouldn't say that it's a common practice. I would say that there are evidentiary matters that occur or arise all the time in a trial that the parties discuss and oftentimes come to an agreement on as to how the evidence is presented. And I would agree that on issues such as element of the offense, drug type, for example, in a post-Apprendi world, or in the example of proving a defendant's prior convictions, that a formal stipulation is the better course. And that's what usually happens. But that does not mean to say that the other type of stipulation arising from discussions among counsel don't also occur. And that's
well, isn't that a problem, though, because you don't have any record of anything? I mean, that's a problem.
Well, it's a problem in this situation, Your Honor, where there's different counsel on appeal and there's an attempt to raise...
I understand that, and I understand I'm sort of going beyond the record asking what the policy is in the office, but, I mean, certainly, in hindsight, having this in writing would be...
I agree, Your Honor. And for the foresight from today would caution to consider the possibility of new counsel on appeal and whether or not there is a chance of an issue attempting to be raised by the silence. But the issue before the court today, Your Honors, is however you view this notice, you can put it aside and review this issue, which you must, for plain error. Now, that is not a sufficiency of the evidence claim which the defendant is attempting to assert. Sufficiency of the evidence, first of all, was never raised before the district court, so how the defendant can raise it here is a question that this court should first consider. But even if you get to the sufficiency, the question there is whether or not the record is devoid of evidence, whether there is no evidence from which a rational jury could find the defendant guilty. You don't consider the admissibility of the evidence on the sufficiency question. You only consider whether the evidence supports the jury's finding. And there clearly was evidence, as Judge Caney has pointed out. Lieutenant Kane testified that this vehicle was manufactured in Arlington, Texas. Now, however the manner in which that evidence was presented to the jury, that was the evidence before the jury, and no one can reasonably say that the record is devoid of evidence. The question Your Honors have to consider is whether the manner in which that evidence was presented to the jury was plain error, resulting in a miscarriage of justice. And this case is no different from the many cases where there may have been an error in instructing the jury, say, on an essential element of the offense. And you can look at the cases post-Apprendi, where what happens in those cases where a district court failed to instruct a jury on an essential element of the offense going to drug weight and drug type? Do we automatically reverse the conviction? Do we go into a sufficiency analysis and say, you didn't prove this, therefore you can't even retry him? No, we don't do that. We look at the question whether or not there was a miscarriage of justice, and on that question, it turns off on the issue whether the issue was disputed.
And so this court you said, as long as there was some evidence, any evidence, that it would not violate the plain error standard. Is there a case you have to that effect?
I do, Your Honor. If you look at on page 43 of our brief, footnote 5, where there is no objection to hearsay evidence, the jury may consider it for whatever value it may have. Such evidence is to be given its natural probative effect as if it were in law admissible. So again, Your Honor, the admissibility of the evidence has no bearing on the sufficiency of the evidence once presented. The only issue here is whether the manner in which that evidence was presented caused a miscarriage of justice. And there can be no miscarriage of justice regarding the manner in which evidence is presented, where the issue about which that evidence relates was undisputed at trial, was unmentioned at trial, and which, as Your Honors have raised here this morning, is indisputable. This court can take judicial notice, not to supplement the record with new evidence, but the court can take judicial notice of the simple fact that Cadillac Escalades are not made in Illinois in order for this court to answer the question whether this conviction resulted in miscarriage of justice.
And what authority do you have for that?
For looking at...
the fact that we can take judicial notice of something that wasn't before the trial court.
Your Honor, in footnote 4 of our brief, I've cited to this court's decision in Laborers Pension Fund versus Blackmore Sewer Construction, Inc.
Do you think that's a civil case, I take it?
It is, Your Honor.
But I think there's any distinction that would be drawn here, since we're...
I don't, Your Honor. And again, it's important to emphasize that I'm not asking Your Honors to consider additional evidence on whether the evidence was sufficient. What I'm saying is that Your Honors can consider or take judicial notice of a fact to determine whether or not a miscarriage of justice occurred. And this court can surely do that, because it has said, as we also cite in our brief, this court's decisions in Ross and in Curley, this court went so far as to say it would be a waste of judicial resources to go back and retry a case based on an error in a jury instruction issue on an element of the offense where the issue was barely contested.
Well, this case wouldn't be retried if it was your opponent was correct, would it?
Well, if he was correct on the sufficiency argument, Your Honor, then the...
If the ruling of this court was that there was a failure of proof on a critical element, you don't get to retry this case.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's exactly right. What I'm saying is that the issue is not sufficiency. It's the error in the admission of the evidence.
And I just want to be clear on these judicial notice comments mm-hmm. that were made. My questions to Mr. Paul related to whether the district court judge could have entertained a motion to take judicial notice of the fact that Cadillacs are not made in Illinois.
He could have. He could have. And again, Your Honor, in hindsight, we could have stated before the jury, affirmed before the jury the stipulation. The government could have asked the district court to take judicial notice. And with respect to this confrontation claim that there was somehow a testimonial hearsay statement, there wasn't an oral testimonial statement regarding the results of this inquiry. It was a vehicle abstract. It was a written document.
Let me get back to this judicial notice. So this laborer's pension fund case, which I didn't have a chance to read before the argument, the Court of Appeals, our court, took judicial notice of the information from the website. Like, I know we can do things like that with respect to immigration cases, with respect to country reports and things like that. So this was a situation where the Seventh Circuit took judicial notice of information in trying to make a determination.
From an FDIC website, Your Honor. And I'm not suggesting to you that you're doing that is critical to your decision. I'm just suggesting to you that you can do that in assisting you in determining whether or not a miscarriage of justice occurred here. Whether or not you take judicial notice, the simple fact is, again, there can be no miscarriage of justice regarding the manner in which evidence is presented if that evidence was not disputed at trial and is indisputable. The real threat to the public reputation and integrity of judicial proceedings would be for this court to reverse this conviction based on an undisputed issue and on an issue which is indisputable. For those reasons, Your Honor, the government would ask that you affirm this conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bass. Mr. Paul, how much time? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Paul.
If the court affirms, it's going to send one message, and that is the government really needn't prove all of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And if the court considers these affidavits that I've submitted...
Why is it not beyond a reasonable doubt? There was no contrary evidence.
Your Honor, there is no obligation to dispute the government's proof. A tactical decision does not relieve the government of its burden of proof. The Supreme Court said that in Estelle versus McGuire.
I get back to that. The only evidence before the jury was that it was transported to interstate commerce.
And that was based on double hearsay. The point is the court has to make too many assumptions to affirm based on the jurisdictional element. It has to assume that the person who looked up the information did so accurately. It has to assume that the database is accurately. It has to assume that the person who reported to Kane did so accurately. And then it has to assume that Kane accurately reported the results to the jury. The court simply has to make too many assumptions. Yes, it was plain error to admit this evidence, but it is also insufficient standing alone. Any evidence isn't the standard. The evidence is whether it was sufficient. A scintilla of evidence won't do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. And thank you very much for taking the assignment in this case and your excellent work you've done on behalf of your client.